Go ahead.
The second case on the docket this morning is 2-22-0170. Silverthorne Development Company, defendant appellant, the Board of Education of Sycamore Community School District number 427, plaintiff appellee. Arguing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. C. Nicholas Cronauer. Arguing on behalf of the appellee, Mr. Matthew J. Gardner.
All right, and Justice Jorgensen has now resolved her technical problems, so she is with us. And you can see her, and you can actually talk to her as opposed to talk to the ceiling like they were doing the last call. All right, so Mr. Cronauer?
Yes.
You may proceed.
All right, thank you. Thank you. May it please the Court, Mr. Gardner. As you know, I'm Nicholas Cronauer. I represent the appellant defendant in this case, Silverthorne. Basically, I just want to give you a brief roadmap. This case, outside looking in, can seem overwhelming because it's so big, but the issues are simple. Basically, should a bedroom be anchored to anything related to life safety? That's the main issue.
Hold on, Mr. Cronauer. Sure. This is being recorded, and I'm not hearing everything, and you want it to be heard.
Yes,
so.
Thank you. Sorry, Ms. Self-Speaker.
Is this better? There we go.
All right, thank you for that. Basically, this is a simple case. There's two big issues. Should a bedroom definition be anchored to the building code is the main issue. And the second issue are the issues of fact as it relates to the restitution claim, I call it, or that deals with the impact fees and being deposited in the operating account. Now, before I begin, is there any questions that I can answer?
We have an understanding of the background. Let's get to the law.
Sure. So
counsel, I'd like to just start with, what is a bedroom?
Justice, is a great question, and that is why there's issues of fact in this case, because there's three different definitions of a bedroom. So do you apply the appraiser definition, which only looks to closets, the MLS definition, which piggybacks off the appraiser definition, there's the ordinance definition, which just says designed or intended to be used for sleeping purposes, there's a dictionary definition, which is anchored to sleeping, and you have the building code, which specifically sets out the criteria for a sleeping room.
Let me ask you this. When you decided to apply for and pay fees based on two bedrooms, what did you have in mind?
It was the building code, because that is what the permit looks to determine whether or not a room is a bedroom as defined by the building code for safety purposes, because it has the life safety criteria met.
So if a two-bedroom home that was sold as a two-bedroom home, or at least listed as a two-bedroom home, and impact fees were paid for a two-bedroom home, later became a three-bedroom or beyond, in addition to a closet or an armoire, were additional smoke detectors placed in those areas, and carbon monoxide, were they all placed in those rooms?
So, to answer your question, the armoire and the closet have no bearing on permitting or a sleeping room.
I understand that, but there was some reference, I believe, in the brief, in the record, that a closet was put in after the walkthrough.
Correct.
Okay. So
after the fees were paid.
Correct, because the fees are paid before construction starts. Right, you can't start until the fees are paid.
So if it went to a three sleeping room house, I guess, were more safety equipment added?
Yes, in order to be a sleeping room, the safety equipment has to be added.
After everything was already wired?
Correct.
So then if you add a closet and you add all the safety requirements, you're conceding that it's a sleeping room now?
Yes, if the safety requirements are there. The closet, absolutely not. The closet has nothing to do with sleeping room.
But everything else, if it's a quote-unquote sleeping room, then it's a bedroom.
Correct.
And so did he pay the fees?
Yes, and this is John Sauter's testimony. Every home was certified that it complied with the building code and the ordinances. Every home met the permit requirements, the sleeping safety requirements at the beginning and the end. There's one home that Mr. Work agreed that they changed the room based on the customer's request, went to the city, went to the school district, and said, hey, we changed this room. What do I have to do to pay you? And they said, I don't know.
So what did they do to pay on all the other ones that they changed the room?
They, There was nothing paid. I mean, that's why this lawsuit was filed. Nothing's been paid on anything that's been, nothing's been changed.
I asked you that before, and you said yes, that it was taken care of. My question is, when you added a closet and or added the things outside, the smoke detector, et cetera, did you pay the fee to make it from a two-bedroom to a three or four?
Well,
in all the others other than the one that they acknowledge, they called and somebody said, I don't know what to do. So in all the other, did they pay it?
No other home has there been any evidence or testimony that any changes were made. There's the one issue with the closet. There's the one home that Mr. Work agreed they tried to change. Otherwise, there's nothing in the record that any of these rooms were changed or had life safety features added after the fact.
Well, they're asking for $66,000 somewhat, $66,649 in lost impact fees. That's not from one home.
No, that's from multiple homes.
Correct.
Based on the MLS listing of a bedroom, which has nothing to do with the building code.
Based on the MLS, then based on what happened after?
No. There's no evidence of any changes occurring after in this case as it relates to building code life safety.
I know, but they were permitted initially as two-bedroom facilities.
Some, not all.
All right, but some in question were.
Correct.
There was also one that was permitted as, I think, a four-bedroom house, but then they decided the husband's daughter would come and live with them, too, and that became then there were five sleeping rooms. Did anything get added to that fifth room to make it safe?
That's not that I'm aware of, because that was a decision made by the customer during this deposition.
Okay, but it became a five-bedroom home. I mean, I hate using sleeping room, bedroom. I'm using them interchangeably. I know they're not defined the same way, but they wanted five bedrooms. They thought they wanted four. Now they wanted five.
Correct.
And so to create that fifth bedroom, nothing had to be done by the developer?
Not after the house has been sold and they moved in. I mean, once that house gets sold to the customer, what they do with the bedrooms are prerogative. And my client can't police that and doesn't police that.
But what were the occasions when something was done by Silverthorne after the walkthrough by the city?
There's the only thing in the record of any changes occurring that would warrant life safety changes for a bedroom is the one time that my client admitted under oath that they tried to make a change. And the city told him, I don't know what to do, talk to the school district. Talk to the school district, they said, talk to the city. It's the only time he agreed there's been a change in
which
the
house
client.
Was that?
I don't have that written down. I apologize. The closet issue is, you know, why this all started, but it's a non-issue because under the building code, closets don't matter because it is not a life safety issue.
But why would the Silverthorne put in the closet after the walkthrough?
Because from an MLS perspective, the MLS won't count it as a bedroom for MLS purposes without a closet. So if the room doesn't have a closet, if any of you are in real estate, you cannot list that room as a bedroom. So then when they go to sell it on the open market, the bedroom would be three, the other room's a bonus room, it's called.
But that's still getting around the impact fees, isn't it?
No, it is not, because what's the foundation for an impact fee, right? An impact fee is not a tax. That's a very important distinction that your honors have to make. Impact fee derives from the police power of the state for life safety. Impact fees have to be uniquely attributable to new development and has to be proportional. If the standard is just any room that has a closet gets an impact fee, that converts the proportionality from a police power to a tax, and that's unlawful. So you have to have some type of objective.
Well, what's the whole intent behind an impact fee?
The intent behind an impact fee is public safety, in that it puts
public safety? How about education?
But that goes back to increasing the capital for the town and putting the cost on the people moving in the town, which is, if you look into the heart of impact fees, the power comes from public safety.
Okay, but the realtor in, I believe, her deposition, and she was the realtor who worked for this developer for some time, said that she had never sold a two-bedroom house? Even she'd never advertised or sold?
Never listed.
Listed, okay.
And I guess respectfully from her perspective, I don't know what she is or is not selling has no bearing or relevance on what Silverthorne is or can sell. In Sycamore today, there's plus 50, very hot homes are plus 55 communities, believe it or not, in Sycamore. There's three developments, and those have nothing to do with kids, but they still pay impact fees. So I think to claim that she's never sold two bedrooms has no bearing on whether or not the houses were permitted properly, all received certificates of occupancy, which state they've been inspected 12 to 15 times, and meet all codes and ordinances. That's what matters, not the realtor saying, well, I've never sold a two-bedroom house. And you have to remember, too, the realtor's jaded towards Mr.
Well, he doesn't have, Silverthorne doesn't have a lot of empty two-bedroom houses out there, does it?
When you say empty, what do you mean?
That didn't get sold?
I mean, with real estate right now, I think houses are selling left and right.
So who sold those homes if she was the exclusive listing agent?
I don't.
Or
she was a prior listing agent. I mean, I don't believe she testified that she sold any specific house that's at issue in this case because of the falling out they had in Cortland. She just had sold houses previously for Mr. Work.
All right, there are 24 houses involved here.
Sounds about right.
I mean, is there an inkling that there might be more, or is this, we're limiting here to 24?
As far as I know, we're starting 2015. These are the only cases, the only houses they've identified. They haven't moved them in the complaints, and the only houses I'm aware of.
But those houses, according to the district, are different than the impact fee that was paid for them.
I mean, that's what they're claiming, but there's nothing in the record to support that. They don't inspect the houses. They don't determine what's a bedroom. They don't determine permitting. They were heard through, you know, it's like the game of telephone, heard through the grapevine that a closet was being added. And to most people, especially realtors, they think, oh, if a closet's being added, that's a bedroom. But once you get in the case, you realize there's way more to this than just is a closet being added. And that's where the school district's at. And I deposed Ms. Stucker, you know, the corporate rep. She had no idea how the ordinance defined a bedroom, and she deferred to the city as far as what they did do, how they do it, and what they do. And if you look at the UDO, the zoning administrator is responsible for policing this. Again, police power, policing this. The zoning administrator was deposed, so there's no fraud, so that it's confusing. They've tried to come up with a more workable definition. I don't know why, when they have the building code, that they could easily just say, see building code for what qualifies as a bedroom. And then we can avoid all these issues with, you know, hearsay, people saying, well, he had a closet, therefore he's getting all the impact fees. That has no bearing on impact fees. And if you look at the Brighton house, you know, the big issue I raised in that is the trial court found that was a four-bedroom house. It's a married couple with no kids. So I arguably it could be a two-bedroom house, which is how it was permitted, a two-bedroom house, not a one-bedroom house. But you cannot logically or factually find that's a four-bedroom house when only two people are living there.
Oh, but that's silly.
But did
that is silly. How many people have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6-bedroom homes, and it's only a husband and a wife? So you're going to say the fact that there's only two people living there and it's listed or it shows four bedrooms, that it's only a two-bedroom house because only two people sleep in one bedroom?
From an impact fee perspective, yes. Because
that's not how they look at impact fees. I mean, I wish that's the way they looked at impact fees. All of our taxes would be much different, wouldn't it? If we didn't have to pay for a school system if we had no kids in the school.
But if impact fees look at the rooms that are actually slept in.
No. No, I disagree with you.
If in that house with the two people and the four
bedrooms,
did those other two bedrooms have the safety features in them?
They did not. They did not. And John Sauer is clear on this. Every house that was permitted for two or three bedrooms, at the end of every inspection, the plans met the blueprints and had the life safety equipment.
But those houses are going to be resold. And they may be resold to a person who has six kids who's going to fit them in two extra bedrooms. Where are those kids going to go to school if they don't have the fees in order to get them in a classroom?
But respectfully, that's not the standard for when an impact fee is paid. I mean, you're not.
It's by bedroom, by sleeping room, by whatever it's called.
Rooms that can actually be slept in.
Yeah. Well, they
all can be slept on. No,
legally.
Slept in.
Legally.
Not that are being slept in, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Which is why the life safety equipment is the key. Because if the life safety equipment's there, they can be slept in. If it's not there, they cannot be slept in. So to answer your question, if a family moves in 10 years and has 8 kids, I mean, they would have to go in and make changes to that house.
Not necessarily. They could put the kids in those 2 rooms or 3 rooms because the husband and wife are only sleeping in one.
But the impact fees look at the people per room. It looks at sleeping rooms.
But once it's sold later, impact fees are no longer an issue.
Correct.
You can wire that house with the extra safety features without having any input in by the district.
Correct, and that, but that's an issue between the district and that family. It's not an issue between the district and my client.
I think what the allegation is here, and I don't think I need to school you on this because I think you're perfectly, you understand perfectly what is being said here, is that your client is trying to avoid the impact fee, and so therefore he didn't say it was a 3-bedroom when in fact it was a 3-bedroom. He asked for a permit for a 2-bedroom, then it was listed as a 3-bedroom. So then who doesn't have to pay the fee? Your client. It's not that he's going to say, I'm done with this. What those people do with it afterwards, that's up to them. I mean, I think you're insulting our intelligence by first saying if it's a 6-bedroom and only somebody's sleeping in one, those aren't bedrooms. I think you've come around now and you've acknowledged that that's not correct. But to come in and now say, well, if it's a 2-bedroom and somebody 3 days later comes in and puts a closet and they buy it, and what's the school going to do, walk around and see who's adding things to the house? I mean, you have to get a permit only if you're changing electric or you're changing plumbing. But as Justice Hutchinson said, if you're adding something like a smoke alarm, they're going to know about that? No.
So I'm not trying to insult anyone here, and I apologize, that's how I came across. I think the issue is, you know, what is a developer required to do?
And if what is the
developer required to do? Required to do to permit a home. And if the standard is every house in the room, every room in the house is subject to an impact fee, the school district could pass, or the city could pass that law. But that's not how the law reads. It's a sleeping room.
Every room was what you call a sleeping room, has a closet or doesn't have a closet, but has all the safety features. If they buy the home from the builder and that's the way the home is, then he should pay the impact fees on however many bedrooms or sleeping rooms there are, right?
So, well, so the issue goes back to what's the definition of a bedroom? Which definition of a bedroom are you applying?
Well, it should be, I think, the definition that the city is requiring them to permit. If he's trying to sell the Ashbury as a 2-bedroom when it actually has 3 rooms that could be designated, maybe that's what we should call, could be designated as sleeping rooms, but he's only selling it as a 2-bedroom, that model has 3 bedrooms, and he should pay for 3 bedrooms.
Every room has a potential to be a sleeping room, though, unless it's anchored to the life safety criteria.
But you can choose, the developer can choose not to put those in and call this a playroom, whatever they're calling it. But when you list a house, and I'm just looking at the Ashbury here because it opened up for me. It's listed as a traditional bedroom plans, 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms. That tells me that should be, the fee for that should be, what, is that the $5,000 one? No, the $3,000 yeah. One, I forget. It goes from $897, I know, up higher. But you're telling me that he could go in and say to the city and to the district by reference, no, that's really only a 2-bedroom house. I'm only going to equip 2 of the bedrooms with safety equipment. And the other room, they can do whatever they want.
Because the MLS does not look at safety equipment. MLS,
it's not, but he's building it for with permitting by the city. It's not what the MLS wants to call it.
And that's the other issue, right? Mm-hmm. The city, he built it for the city. And the city said everything that he did met the permits, met the plans, met occupancy, got a certificate.
Because he had a receipt for paying for a two-bedroom. That's all it required.
No. 12 to 15 inspections. 12 to 15 inspections each one of these houses go through. They have to get certificate of occupancy. They all have a certificate of occupancy that says this house has been inspected and is found to comply with all codes and ordinances. That includes the UDO. So, again, yes, they're billing it for the city. If the city approves it, agrees with it, and signs off on it, that should be the standard, not what the school district thinks a bedroom is.
Counsel, if your client were to build a 12-room house and the prospective customer said, I want a smoke detector in every room, would it then be excluding the kitchen, an 11-bedroom home?
Huh? Well, it depends, because that room also needs an egress window.
Right, they all have windows. Let's assume they all have windows, and sporadically around there are CO2 detectors as well. Are they all then bedrooms?
If you have to have an objective criteria that meets the building code, then I would say yes. You have to have a definition somewhere. If that's the definition I'm advocating, that would be the definition that should be applied.
Your client could build a 15-room house, put a smoke detector in one room, and then build this, pay impact fees based on a single bedroom. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
I mean, it comes down to, again, what is the intended use? And if, in your example, it's a super wealthy individual, man or woman, who has no family, no kids, but wants a big house, that impact fee is proper. If it's someone trying to game the system, I mean, that, again, becomes an issue for the city, the school district, and that home buyer.
Well, when he pays that fee, it's before he normally would have a buyer. So he doesn't necessarily, he might be building some models in there and building some homes. That somebody could buy, and they don't really care. I mean, it's got two, I mean, they've got the kids, but he's, you know, they're buying it, but he still sold it to the city and to the district as a two-bedroom house.
Some are specs, a lot are customer built. I mean, I don't think there's a breakdown of what's what, but if it's a spec home and he permits it as a spec home and sells it, and again, meets all the inspections, gets certificate occupancy, and the homeowner changes
sold it. He spec'd it as a two-bedroom, two-sleeping-room home, and she sold it as a four.
Well, she sold it under a different definition.
Okay.
She didn't sell it. No one has testified that these homes, as they were sold, they knew what the UDO said. What the appraiser does, what the MLS does, it's the number of rooms that can hold beds. And as John Sauter said, a bedroom is independent of a sleeping room. So just because it's listed as a bedroom doesn't mean it's a sleeping room. So because the MLS says this is a bedroom does not mean this is a room that can be slept in. It means it's a room that can house a bed or do other things, game room, den, whatever it may be. So if he built a spec home, I mean, I think that makes it even more innocuous. He built a home, two beds, three rooms, or two sleeping rooms, three bedrooms. If he sells it as a spec and someone buys it and then uses that third room as sleeping, that's not on the developer. It's on the homeowner.
Justice Jorgensen, do you have anything else you wanted to add?
I do not. I do not have any additional questions. Thank you.
Justice? All right. You'll have an opportunity to respond. We took you past your time with questions.
Thank you.
And Mr. Gardner.
Just one question. Justice Jorgensen, is there a way to turn your volume down?
Yeah. Sorry, I apologize if I appeared to be yelling.
Well, you are yelling. No.
How about that?
We're working on it.
Is that better?
Yes.
That's better. Right there.
Okay.
And whoever did it, thank you. I don't know if it was you or Jeff, but all right, Mr. Gardner, I think we're ready. Thank you.
May it please the court, Matt Gardner from Robin Schwartz, representing Sycamore School District 427.
Now you have to pull that up a little bit.
I'm sorry if I'm too loud. Let me know. Sometimes I can
be too tall for where that was.
There. You had some wonderful questions, Your Honors. I can tell you've read the briefs. You're familiar with this. I think, as counsel started, this is a straightforward case. There's a lot of records. There are a lot of facts There are some side issues, but when you boil it down, this is a pretty straightforward case. Counsel mentioned there's two issues that he's addressing. One, the definition of a bedroom, and also the fourth counterclaim. So going to the definition of a bedroom, I can certainly address...
Is it a question of fact what a sleeping purpose or sleeping room means?
No, I think that's a question of law.
Is it subjective?
No. There is a definition. Well, it could be, I mean, there needs to be objective evidence to support that finding, but it is a question of law as to whether, as with all statutory or ordinance interpretation, it's a question of law. It's straightforward. And when interpreting that law, a court's role is to take the, is to ascertain the intent of the drafters. Here, the City of Sycamore's City Council. The best way to do that, case law says, is to look at the plain and ordinary meaning of the language. And Section 1.33 of the Unified Development Ordinance says, in clear, plain language, a bedroom is any room designed, intended, or used principally for sleeping purposes. There is no reason that it needs to, that the court or anyone else in interpreting, whether it be John Saunders or the school district, anyone else needs to refer to a separate ordinance, the building code, and a separate definition, a sleeping room. You know, Silverthorne puts a lot into John Saunders' testimony. It's a question of law.
Counsel, could I interrupt you and ask you this? If we assume that definition is the appropriate way to define what a bedroom is it designed, used, and intended to be used for sleeping purposes at the time the fee is paid or at the time the house is completed?
I don't think the statute really addresses that.
Is that then a question of fact?
Well, what I would say to that question is the building permit application that Jim Work from Silverthorne fills out has a certification stating that if anything changes after they fill out that form, they are required to update that form. John Saunders testified about that as such as well. That was never performed by Silverthorne, even on that one home that he mentioned where there was a change.
But they weren't structural changes. I mean, I think that was part of his response. They weren't structural, so it's okay.
Sure. I mean, realistically, I don't think there were many changes. Silverthorne marketed these homes. We had testimony from the broker and from John Saunders of Silverthorne intentionally misrepresenting the homes to get around the contribution fee. The intent is not an issue here, first of all. We do have a claim for fraud, but that's not an issue here today. But they misrepresented the number of bedrooms to get around the contribution fee. As soon as that was done, we have evidence showing that they were marketing these homes directly to home buyers, also through their broker, as 3 to 4 bedrooms. So Silverthorne can sit there and say it's, you know, what definition applies. But really, the only time they raise that question of a bedroom is when they're paying contribution fees, when they're required to pay contribution fees. They have a clear understanding of what a bedroom is when they're marketing these properties and trying to get money, because obviously marketing a 3-bedroom home is more valuable than a 2-bedroom home. So it's a little disingenuous, especially, no other home builder in Silverthorne had this problem. All the other developers were paid the contribution fees as required by their properties. The only issue is that in this case, Silverthorne was paying multiple properties for less than. So,
were any other builders advertising or listing them as 2-bedroom and then changing them and then coming in and paying the fee?
I have no evidence of that. I have no record of that. Just to kind of summarize, I do think it's a basic rules statutory interpretation thing. I don't think we need to get into, these other definitions. John Saunders, again, question of law, I don't think his testimony is particularly relevant, but he did say the definition of a bedroom under Unified Development Ordinance is broader than the definition of the MLS or the definition under the sleeping code. So, you know, if going to that question of whether there was smoke alarm in the kitchen, I don't think that would qualify as a bedroom for purpose of the Unified Development Ordinance because it was not designed for, you know, sleeping purposes. And I think the one other thing to add there is, you know, it's not just how it's intended use. It's also, it's not just how it's intended or used, which is, I think, what Silverthorne's really relying on. It's how it's designed. And again, Silverthorne's own marketing documents, their own communications and portal documents with the purchaser show that it's designed. I want to get to all the issues since I don't have rebuttal. Are there any other questions on this?
I have a real quick question. What is the basis for an impact fee? What's the intent?
Good question. So I do not think it's a public safety issue. It's simply these homes are built. You have a whole bunch of kids moving into a subdivision, and schools need to have the facilities in place to accommodate these students. The way the taxing works in Illinois is these homeowners do not pay property taxes until the following year. So the school districts are left for a year where they're paying for, they need to pay for costs to house these students or facilities to educate these students. That would be my answer to that question.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Going to the issues of fact on count one, the school district, as I've described, set forth numerous facts. Testimony from Mr. Work and Mr. Almaday themselves, where they acknowledge certain homes consisted of the bedrooms as alleged in the school district's complaint. The testimony and the real estate documents from the district's broker, affidavits and testimony from the homeowners themselves, who said Silverthorne represented that this was a 3 or 4 bedroom home. We have multiple instances there, and the portal documents, where Silverthorne itself is making admission where that these are 3 or 4 bedroom homes. At no time were they distinguishing the different definitions there. Silverthorne failed to produce any evidence indicating that these homes were anything but the bedrooms as alleged in the complaint in this summary judgment motion. They state that Jim Work distinguished the facts and the allegations. But really, if you look at, they don't quote that testimony. If you actually go through and read Mr. Work's testimony, he's simply distinguishing it based on the definition of the bedroom versus sleeping room. I just want to quote one thing. He said, the question was asked, would you dispute any affidavit that has the same language in those properties that he addressed, and Mr. Work stated, quote, yeah, as I said earlier, I don't know, what's the definition of a bedroom? Who are you asking? And that's referring to all of the other properties that he was trying to distinguish. Before I move on to the fourth counterclaim, are there any additional questions I can answer?
No. None for me.
Not for me. Justice Jorgensen?
None.
All right.
Okay. Turning to the fourth counterclaim, which, as you know, alleges that the school district was depositing these contribution fees in their general fund and using them for general education purposes, which is outside the scope of the city's ordinance and not permitted within the municipal code. The school district moved for summary judgment on this, set forth specific evidence from Nicole Stuckert, who is the chief school business official, the assistant superintendent for Sycamore School District. In that affidavit, Ms. Stuckert stated that contribution fees had only been used twice in the last 10 years, in 2012 for the modification of Sycamore Middle School, excuse me, and for the purchase of, in 2015, the purchase of real estate next to the school district. These expenditures were also reflected on the annual contribution fee audit that the school district does. And those were attached to the affidavit.
Okay, I understand that there's no requirement, statutory requirement, that there be separate bank accounts, mm-hmm, for these eight or nine funds that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But wouldn't that be a better practice?
I'm not an accountant. I will say this is standard practice. As someone who represents schools and works with them on finances, this is standard practice that's actually governed by ISB regulations. It's not just District 427 doing their own thing. This is an ISB-regulated process. And some of these funds, such as the O&M fund or the Ed fund, are actually statutorily authorized and required, not just through the ISB, Illinois State Board of Education regulations.
The one accounting or that she could not speak to, she said she didn't write that.
Right.
Was there testimony that with even though they were listed incorrectly, that those monies were ever used for anything other than school-related?
No, there was Ms. Stuckert. There was no testimony that Ms. Stuckert, from anybody, about how these funds were used. There's a conclusory statement from Mr. Grant, the Silverthorne's expert, but there's no evidence otherwise of how these funds were used. And with respect to that, you know, that identification, that document that Ms. Stuckert couldn't testify about, again, there's a number of procedural and evidentiary issues with that, but those are not the contribution fees that are at issue here. Those are impact fees from municipal and county governments. And, it, you know, we raised this in our response brief, and Silverthorne, this was another quote, I'm sorry to quote, Silverthorne's reply brief claims that plaintiff makes the absurd argument that Ms. Stuckert never testified that, quote, impact fees from municipal or county governments, which the name suggests for itself, were Silverthorne's contribution fees or related to the contribution fee ordinance. They then block, quote, some of Ms. Stuckert's testimony, and at no time does she say these are Silverthorne's contribution fees or these are related to the contribution fees through the Unified Development Ordinance. In fact, it says, and that this is during the deposition, that would be impact fees you receive from the city of Sycamore and developers, correct? Correct. So it's a little, you know, it's vague there. Again, this would be, at this point, Silverthorne's burden to raise an affirmative fact because the school district already set forth facts. And there, I don't think there's any evidence that those were the contribution fees from Silverthorne or any developers. And
Mr. Grant sort of relied on that
statement. Exactly what he relied upon. And so this deposition of Ms. Stuckert was after we filed our motion for summary judgment, and we subsequently filed a supplementary motion based on some of this additional evidence. In that statement of facts, Ms. Stuckert had a supplemental affidavit addressing these impact fees from municipal or county governments, which clearly identifies that these are transfer taxes from the city of Sycamore. It doesn't change her deposition testimony. It isn't in conflict with her deposition testimony as much as Silverthorne wants to make it out. And she is able to identify a separate line item on that same document. It's an annual document. You know, again, it's not an evidence, which are contributions from private developers, I believe is the term. Contributions and donations from private sources. And the figures all match up that those are the contribution fees from Silverthorne and other similar developers, and that those were deposited into O&M. Again, where it's deposited is really not relevant. It is the evidence that is at issue is how it was used.
This sounds a lot like some of the marriage cases we deal with where you see that the funds are in one entity and this fund is used for a family matter, therefore it takes away its non-marital status. Do we have any evidence of any switching between accounts or funds here that can be identified?
No, there's been no evidence of that. Mr. Work alleged that in his testimony.
Right. Well, I think Mr. Grant says that it would be difficult to tell, but do we have anybody telling?
I would disagree with that. I mean, I can tell you the statute, Section 17.2A of the Illinois School Code, to transfer funds from O&M to Ed, you need to post 7 days' notice and have a public hearing. So this transfer, and you know, these public bodies, these schools in particular, are all audited. So oftentimes I'll get an auditor calling me for school saying, hey, you know, your district is trying to make this transfer without going through the notice. This notice would have had to been published, and that would have been an easy way to identify that. And even then, I mean, there's still tax revenue that's coming in from the O&M fund, from property taxes. The O&M fund is not solely consistent of these contribution funds. So if there was a transfer, it certainly could have been just some of the property tax revenue, which is allowed under law to be transferred to the Ed fund.
And they put the taxing revenue in the same O&M fund?
Well, they account for it separately. I mean, they have separate accounting, but it is deposited into O&M.
Same fund, yeah.
Okay. And I know I have it. I just have to put it in words. Do we have any activity of building major repairs, new schools going on during this period of time? Are those funds pretty much staying there?
Aside from those two expenditures of contribution funds? I'm not aware of any other funds. I would assume that they probably did, because that's a 10-year period. It's very surprising that schools wouldn't be building things, but there's no evidence that that was used through through these contribution fees.
And there's also some evidence here, or some suggestion here, that their actual fund for which they pay teachers and things was always running short.
Frankly, I don't necessarily follow that argument myself. I don't think that's particularly relevant, you know, the school's financial condition. We have the documents showing that these funds were kept and used only for these purposes. Ms. Stucker was asked about this. I think she was asked about tax warrants. Mm-hmm. And she testified that that's a way, even when we are running a deficit, that is a way how we do, it's a way how we're able to make these payments to general education funds without having to resort to using restricted purpose funds like this.
All right. Justice Jorgensen?
I do have one additional question, and I apologize, I'm going back to the bedrooms.
But, that's okay.
You know, if we assume it's designed, used, intended, et cetera, for sleeping purposes, did all these bedrooms or would-be bedrooms share common features? And if so, what were those common features?
No, other than those, no physical, I mean, I'm not sure, other than about the physical features. The common features would be the advertising by Silverthorn, the MLS documents, the ordinance.
No, I got that.
Right.
My question is,
physical
what
features?
Did the rooms have in common that you're saying are now bedrooms?
I don't know that. I do know a couple of them certainly have closets that were added. Again, I don't think the closets is relevant other than showing, you know, the intent of the design.
Okay.
Justice,
thank you.
And I have none. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Cronauer, if you have anything to reply, you may do so at this time.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll be brief. Just to pick off where we left off, this relates to the impact fees. There's testimony, the affidavit from Mr. Grant. He relied on 3,000 sworn records in addition to Ms. Duggar's testimony, which includes the budgets. He talks about $253,000 in impact fees that aren't accounted for, the negative bank balance, which means the bank balance is negative in the one account, the money has been spent. It's literally been spent. We have one account. There's a negative $323,000 bank balance. The money's spent. They say, yeah, we're accounting for it in this spreadsheet, but the money has been spent. That's the Raintree case. $10,000, $93,000 to pay fiduciary taxes used by impact fees. Those aren't conclusions. Those are specific facts. You know, I want to talk briefly about the second affidavit, right? First affidavit, she says it goes into operating and maintenance. Her deposition, I pin her down, she says it goes in the education fund, two different accounts, and then says, well, that must have been a mistake. Then the second affidavit comes and she says, oh, I double-checked and it went into the operations and maintenance fund. She doesn't identify anywhere in the record what she looked at, the account number, but if you look at my brief...
Well, we know what the account number is. It's only one account.
No, she... Well...
The fund number?
Well, that's the confusion. The fund for operations and maintenance, what's funding that account, right? So the issue in this case is she told me it's account 1930, right? County and local taxes. The city doesn't pay impact fees. Developers do. That's going into the education fund. There's only one other fund. If you look at page 37, just look at that chart. There's only one other fund that could possibly be impact fees. And that's right above, and it's going into the educational fund again and the operations and maintenance fund. But an affidavit cannot be used to contradict deposition testimony. And that's exactly what happened. For that reason, there's an issue of fact. Briefly for... the question of fact issue, and I think that's a good question because the problem with the affidavits that were supplied is no one in those affidavits said the phrase, these rooms were designed or intended to be slept in. They simply said it was a four-bedroom house, so that was a four-bedroom house. But no one has crossed the bridge to say it was intended to be slept in. And without that evidence, there's a question of fact.
So if you call it a bedroom, there has to be an intent to have someone asleep in it?
Under the code, absolutely. Absolutely. And that isn't, intent, again, is a question of fact. And since we're on the definition of intent, Mr. Gardner talked about, you know, they have proof of fraudulent intent. John Sauter testified under oath that certificates of occupancy were not obtained by the defendant through any sort of fraudulent pretense. And that's C-4475. He denies it. The realtor, who was upset with Jim over a bad business deal, said she heard. She heard he was doing that. She never said he was doing it. She had knowledge of it. She heard.
Didn't she testify, though, to one specific time when he told her it's cheaper if I do it this way? Didn't she testify to that in her deposition?
I don't recall.
Wait, let me see. No, I have it. She did. Yeah, I think.
But the issue with that is, again, she is thinking as a realtor.
Yeah, here it is. Oh, Keith Almaday, a former partner in defendant's business. Almaday replied that the city charged more for 3 bedrooms than it did for 2 bedrooms. So the builder waited until the city was done, and the builder added a closet to make the room a bedroom.
Which, again, is totally irrelevant under the standard for.
That is irrelevant with respect to the definition. Maybe you're splitting hairs there. But there's testimony that a former partner indicated that that was his intent in not adding the closet in the first place and then doing it afterwards because it costs less.
But again, it's a red herring because there's also testimony that they invited the city in when they were adding this closet, open and obvious, show it to them, let them see it, and they didn't get penalized for it because the closet has no bearing under the sleeping purposes.
Well, the city isn't going to be concerned about it as long as it's not structural. It's the district that's concerned about it, and the district doesn't have, to my knowledge, and I haven't seen it anyplace in this record, an inspector who goes through these houses before the certificate of occupancy is issued.
Correct, which is why they have to rely on the zoning administrator, which is John Sauter. Mm-hmm. And this is more than structural. I mean, it's really not structural because a smoke detector is not structural. I guess a window arguably is structural.
But we're not putting a closet in a wall, unless it's the wall that's holding up the entire house, is not structural.
Right.
It's cosmetic almost.
Right.
But it's being done because somebody wants to use that as a sleeping room.
Or a bigger room with more space for a closet.
Okay.
And just lastly, to answer your question, no builder has ever gone to the city and paid to change the plans because there is no process in place to do that, as has been established. And when we tried, we were told, I don't know what to do.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. All right. Counsel, thank you for your arguments this morning. We appreciate them. And thank you for paying attention to our technology here, too, because this can be heard by others sometime after tomorrow. So thank you very much. We will take the matter under advisement. There will be a decision issued in due course. We're going to take one last recess to prepare for our next case.